Hello, good evening. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back after a whole month of Yom Tovim and Shavuotim. And it's exciting to start our second year of this conference call, Baruch Hashem. Once again, I want to thank the woman that arranged this and keep it going. And I plan on Mirat Hashem continuing the same way. Learning the halachas that are relevant, especially to women and to all of us, and saying Yedvar Torah on the parasha every week. This week I wanted to begin talking about halachas of toys on Shabbos. There are many different issues that can arise with children's toys on Shabbos. There are questions of muktzah, there are issues of bairer, when you're cleaning them up and sorting them. There are other various malachas. So I thought it would be a good idea to dedicate a couple of shiurim to this important topic. So let's begin with Lego, small Lego. Not the bigger type, but rather the smaller, the one that come in those very overpriced sets. So when you make Lego, the pieces attach together quite tightly and quite securely, as anyone who has tried to pry apart those small little Lego bricks will know, and they form a finished vessel of some sort, a car, a boat, or some action figure, etc. And it's formed of these small little pieces which hold together quite tightly and can remain like that for quite a while, provided no other child steps on it. So Lego has an issue of bina, of building. Now, obviously, Lego is not connected to the ground, so it's not that type of building. But there is another type of bina, which is called binyan bikelim, which means building a vessel, building a kli, building something usable. If someone connects different parts of a vessel to complete and make a finished product, this is an issur of bina bikelim. It's not your classic binyan, which is binyan bikarka, building something attached to the ground, which would be building a house or any sort of even tiny little binyan or tiny little building or tiny little pole that you attach to the ground. That's the classic type of building that you think of, but that's the image that gets conjured up when you think of the malach of bina. But the malach of bina applies to kalim as well. If you connect various different pieces to make a finished vessel, that involves the Isser of Baina as well. The case that the Gemara gives is, interestingly, a menorah, which didn't necessarily mean the type used on Hanukkah or any type of candelabra, and it was made up of various different parts, and it came apart, and then you screwed it together to reassemble it. And the Gemara says that if you assemble it on Shabbos, it's chai v'chatas, it's a transgression of the Isser of Baina. Another case the Gemara gives is a telescoping pole that was used to paint or to plaster ceilings. So it was a few different sizes of a pole, which, depending on what sort of height you wanted to reach, you either screwed them or unscrewed them. And the Gemara says that this is also an issue of binyan. So therefore, it would seem that when assembling a Lego project, it would possibly be a question of binyan. After all, it involves many small different pieces which attach together securely and form a product of a car or boat. However, Lego differs in the way that it's not meant to be left that way. And it's clear to everybody that it's just a toy and it's not a permanent construct. And it's intended to be disassembled and reassembled as many times as it's enjoyable. And therefore, it changes its status. For example, we know that you're allowed to screw the cover of a soda bottle on and off, right? Although it screws on very tightly, and it can remain that way forever, but it's not meant to remain that way. And being that it's not meant to remain that way, you're allowed to do it. It's not called binyan. You can even screw and unscrew the cover of a salt shaker, even though a salt shaker is pretty rare that you uncover it, and it's only once in a while when the salt runs out. But it doesn't make a difference because the design is specifically done in a way that it's not meant to be permanent. It's meant to be removable at times. And if so, this would be a reason to allow Lego construction. Now, this just to make a distinction here, it would not apply to a, let's say, a model airplane, right, where the parts attach firmly, and once you're done, it's meant to remain that way forever. So a model car, a model airplane, that type of construction would be prohibited on Shabbos, because you're creating a plane out of small parts, which is meant to be a plane and remain a plane. And therefore, that wouldn't be allowed. Now, lahalacha, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach Zatzal allowed children under 12 to play with Lego, but suggested that adults should not be involved in the process. He said it's okay for children. You don't have to stop children from doing it, but it's not okay for adults. So what he said was that, you can have your child to play with it, and you can help him, and you can read the directions for him, but you shouldn't be the one putting the pieces together or prying them apart and so on and so forth. You should just allow your child to do that. So that's something to keep in mind if your children are playing with Lego. I want to point out another thing, that this happens often, is that when you buy a new toy, so many times new toys, and this is not specifically Lego, any type of new toy, they come with a number of pieces. And the way they come is that all those pieces are attached together, either like on a plastic rod, or they're like on this sheet, and you like sort of poke out the pieces, break off the pieces, and then you assemble them, or sometimes those are the playing pieces. You just break them off and use them. And the issue here, there's two possible issues here, and this was likely not permissible even for children, because when you break them off, that's a question of makah bepatish. You're completing the vessel. Now, although the vessel itself is basically complete, but it's missing that last part, which is breaking it off, which then makes it usable, that's questionably a problem of makah bepatish. Of finishing something. Makah patish means when you have a vessel which is built, but it's missing the completing touch, the final bang of the hammer, so to speak. That's what makah patish is. And over here, these pieces are all attached to the plastic and they're unusable that way. And then when you break them off, you make them usable. And therefore, it's a question of makah patish. So that should be done before Shabbos. And also, a lot of times, these games that come with these pieces that are meant to be assembled, that assembly also might be more of a question if it's an assembly that is intended to remain that way. In other words, sometimes games come in a way that you just are meant to assemble them one time and then use them forever in that way, and then that would be a bigger question of Baina Bekalim, of building a vessel on Shabbos, so a shaila should be asked before doing something like that. This week's Parsha Noach talks about Noach, clearly. And Noach is a very interesting persona. He's a person who, there are many conflicting statements in Chazal, and it's very hard to understand who Noach was. Some Chazal, some Midrashim, some Gemaras, and certainly the Psukim seem to heap praise upon Noach, and others seem to criticize him. Now, clearly, we understand very little about Noach and very little about anybody of that stature. And certainly any criticism that is said about Noach we're talking about a subatomic-sized fault. I mean, we're talking about a person that the Pasuk calls a tzaddik and a tamim. So just to keep that in mind about anything that I am about to say and Chazal I'm about to quote, it's all to be understood in context of who we're talking about, of Noach. And mainly the point here is not so much to teach us about Noach, but to teach us about ourselves, and a message and a lesson about how we should conduct ourselves and how we should do our Avodas Hashem, not as much as we understand how exactly it applied to Noach. So with that in mind, I want to try to understand a little bit about a debate that Rashi mentions right in the beginning of the Parsha. The Pasuk says that Noach was a tamim b'dereisav. He was a tamim, which means he was complete. He was perfect. But it says a strange thing. It says tamim b'dereisav. He was complete in his generation. Now right there you have an inherent contradiction. If someone is complete and perfect, then there's no qualifying statement that follows that. He can't be complete and perfect in his generation. If he's complete and perfect, that's an absolute quality, isn't it? How could you be complete and perfect in your generation? So therefore, Rashi mentions two opposing views, how to understand this. One view says that if Noach would have lived in Avraham's generation, he would have been even greater. He could have grown to even greater heights. And therefore, he was Tamim and Tzaddik in his generation, and would he have been another generation, he would have been even greater. The other view says the opposite. Relative to his generation, he was perfect. But had he lived in Avram's generation, in Avram's time, he wouldn't have been considered anything special. Now, this seems so strange. Like, why would Chazal choose to make a criticism out of a pasuk that's clearly trying to extol the praises of Noach? I mean, the pasuk is saying he's a tzaddik and a tamim. Why would they translate the pasuk into a criticism when there is clearly an option to learn it as a praise? Furthermore, the two approaches don't seem to be mutually exclusive. They can both be true. Now, they both agree that Noach could have been greater. He was what he was in his generation, and would he have been in another generation, he could have been greater. That they both agree. They both agree that in Avram's generation, there would have been room to improve. But the difference is how they look at Noach. One says, okay, look at Noach's potential. If he did this well in a terrible generation, imagine how much he could have grown in Avram's time. And the other says, no, look at what he was. That wouldn't have gotten him far in Avram's time. Now, that's true. Where he was wouldn't have gotten him far. But in Avram's time, he would have grown so much. So why focus on what he was, like the second shot, rather than focus on his inherent potential? We're talking about the same person. We're talking about the same ability. And we're talking about the same possibility. So why is it that one chat says, okay, look at his potential, he could have grown so much more, and why the other one says, no, look at what he ended up being, and that wouldn't have been anything in Avram's time. What's going on here? So a number of Mepharshim talk about this from different angles, and they seem to agree on one common ground. There's a significant difference between Avram's approach to Avodas Hashem and Noach's approach. Avram did everything in his power to influence the people around him. What do we know about Avram? Says Esa Nefesh, next week's parasha, Esa Nefesh Asher Asa B'Charan. They took along with them all the people that they created in Charan. What does that mean? The people they converted, the people that they taught about Avodas Hashem, the people that taught about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a number of times that Avraham Avinu was Vayikra B'Shem Hashem. He called out in the name of Hashem, which means he taught the people around him. He called out and he announced on a pedestal all about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He gave speeches. He gave seminars. And he invited people into his house and taught them about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avraham Avinu was constantly trying to teach and spread the word of Hashem's greatness to the world. Noach, however, had a different approach. He tried to shield himself from the negative influence of his community. He retreated into solitude, protected himself from all the things that were going on outside his house, and that's the way he served Hashem. That's the way he grew. So now, if Noach would have lived in the time of Avram, he wouldn't have changed his approach. His approach was the way he deemed was the correct way to serve Hashem. His conclusion was the correct way to serve Hashem is to protect yourself from falling into Aveir, protect yourself from losing your level as a result of the people around you. So he would have continued with his approach. Rather, he would have been able to grow more because being that the generation wasn't so bad, he wouldn't have had to dedicate so much time to resisting the outside influences. So one Chazal says, look, if he would have been given the opportunity to live in Avram's time when people weren't so bad, imagine how great he could have become, how much of a Yorah Shamayim, a Tamim, a Tzaddik he would have been. However, the other Chazal says, once he would have lived in Avram Avinu's generation, he would have been compared to Avram's style of Avodas Hashem. The two paths in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have been compared side by side, one of going into solitude and growing that way, and the other of reaching out and trying to make everybody around you influence in Avodas Hashem. And in that light, Noach's approach would not have been valued at all. The Auschwitz says, that why did Hashem command Noach to build a teva? There are easier ways to save him and all the animals. So the Auschwitz quotes the Zohar. The Zohar says that Hashem said to Noach, you didn't protect your generation. You didn't daven for them. You sat in your house and ignored what was going on around you. You didn't worry about what was going to happen to the whole generation. And therefore, you will be trapped inside the teva for 12 months. You will be totally committed to serving and feeding and maintaining all the animals of the world. It was a lesson to Noach, a lesson of the responsibility to care and to go out and do what you can for the world around you. Rashi quotes that Noach and his children didn't sleep for 12 months. They had a gargantuan task on their hands. Can you imagine how busy a typical zookeeper is just for a few exhibits? And here there were thousands, or perhaps millions, every species. All of them had to be fed, and the Gemara says each one had a particular diet, and you had to locate their food and bring it to them in time. The Medrash says that Noach was groaning and coughing up blood. The Mashal Chachma, as well, quotes a Medrash, which compares Moshe Rabbeinu to Noach. Noach begins the parasha called an Ish Tzadik, but ends the parasha, is referred to as an Ish Ha'adama, a man of the earth, which isn't a complimentary description. Moshe Rabbeinu begins his life as Ish Mitzri, a Mitzri person, but ends it, in the recent parasha we just learned, Ish Ha'alekim, a man of God. The Mashal Chachma explains that the Medrash is pointing out the difference between the two approaches. Noach tried to lock himself away from the influence of the outside world to the point where he didn't even attempt to help or elevate them at all. And he says that the Torah frowns upon this approach, even though ultimately one would think that that's the right way to maintain and grow Yiras Shamayim. That's the safest way and the most surefire way to become great. In truth, the Torah tells us the opposite happened. Noach fell from his level. Moshe Rabbeinu gave his life to helping others. He dedicated his life to seeing what he could do to help Yidden and to save them and daven for them. And as a result, he became the Ish-Elekim. Our Gedolim dedicated their lives to helping others. There's an expression in Yiddish, a tzaddik in pelts, which means a tzaddik who hides behind his fur coat. This was not considered a complimentary statement. The greatness was achieved by going out there and helping the world. Rav Moshe Feinstein's Zatzal was so busy answering questions and talking to people that he had to wake up at 5 in the morning to learn, because that was the only time he was able to learn uninterrupted. There was a person that became aware of this, and he figured he'll call Rav Moshe, then I'll get through. You know, normally it was so busy, he could never get through. So he came up with this brilliant idea to call him at 5 o'clock in the morning. So he did this once or twice, and Rav Moshe graciously answered. And after the third time, Rav Moshe realized what was going on, so Rav Moshe kindly asked him, so please call during regular hours, because everyone is entitled to some time to learn. Imagine if a person of the brilliance and stature of Moshe Feinstein would have just kept to himself and learned day and night. Imagine the svarim he could have authored and the amount of Torah he could have produced. But Moshe dedicated his life to others. He understood that that's what growth and greatness is. Rav Chaim Oizer Grudzinski, who was the Gadol Hador right before the war, and he was answered so many shilas that when they would mail from overseas to Poland, they would just write Rav Chaim Oizer Grudzinski, Poland, and they would already know where to deliver it. And he said that when he was younger, he thought that he had come to this world to author the Sefer Achiezer, that's the name of his Sefer, but as he grew older, he realized that he came to this world just to help others. I'll tell you a story I just read, a beautiful story. There was a tzaddik who lived in Tel Aviv. His name was Rav Nissim Polach. And he passed away in 2009. At his levayah, someone got up and told the following story. He said Rav Nissim had a small miklat, like this, a bomb shelter, and it served as a base medrash where he would teach people who were very, very far from Yiddishkeit, very far from Judaism. He dedicated his life to trying to be mekarev of other people. One night, he was expecting a number of people to come to his shiur, but only one non-religious boy showed up. So after a while, it became clear that no one else was going to come. So the boy asked him, maybe we could learn, just me and you. Rav Nissim insisted, no, we have to get more people to come and learn. We have to try to reach as many people as we can. So they went up to the street, and they began looking for potential customers. So unfortunately, this didn't yield any results. And the boy asked again, can we just start learning? He said, no, we really have to try to get other people. So he went with the boy to the nearest building and knocked on the first door, although the boy was getting really uncomfortable. And he knocks on the door. A non-religious Jew opens the door and says, well, what would you like? And Rav Nissim innocently asked the man, perhaps you'd be interested in joining a Torah class. The man turned white in front of them and began to almost collapse. So quickly they rushed him, they sat him down, they got him some water. After he calmed down a little, he brought them to the next room. There was a rope hanging from the light fixture with a noose tied at the end. He explained, I was about to take my own life. And I was just about to do it, and I said, God, show me that you exist. Send me a sign. That second, you knocked on the door and invited me to a share. The person saying the story said, I know the story is true because it was me. And he said, let me illustrate how far I was from religion. Because he said that there was a street in Bnei Brak called Hashemer, which runs through exclusively the ultra-religious neighborhoods. And it used to be open on Shabbos. And as was the situation mostly in Eretz Yisrael, they tried to get these streets closed. There shouldn't be Chol Shabbos in the middle of their neighborhood. And they made a lot of protests and petitions, and eventually the government agreed to close it for Shabbos. On the first week that they put a chain across the road, this man was saying that me and my friend, we decided we're going to run through it and knock it over. So we drove top speed through that chain. The chain broke, but it snapped back and shattered the windshield. He said, my friend died, and I was injured. So he said, that's how far away I was from Yiddishkeit, and Rav Palach saved me not only spiritually, he saved me physically as well. That's the power of reaching out to the people around us and the responsibility that the Torah is trying to demonstrate, that all these different chazals are trying to demonstrate to us, that although it would seem of utmost importance to shield ourselves, and it certainly is, but at the same time we have to do what we can to try to influence and try to be makariv and to teach and to inspire the people around us as well. Have a good Shabbos and a good evening. Kol tov.